First, you've already met Jim Monroe, who's a writer and executive producer of the movie we're seeing, Ghosts with Shit Jobs. Next to
We haven't seen the movie yet, so wait till you see the movie and then.
In the center, we have Andrew Plotkin, an interactive fiction guru. And to the far right, we have Randall Monroe. I'll let you take it away from here.
Terrific. Okay, so how this event happened in the first place. Basically, we spent about 3 years and 7,000 volunteer hours making Ghosts with Shit Jobs. So we really wanted to bring it on the road. We wanted to take it on tour to audiences like yourself. And so we did a Kickstarter, basically, with a $5,000 goal, and we ended up hitting $20,000 with it, which was amazing. But just as great as the money was connecting with all these people who were super excited with how we made the movie and like how we were planning to get it out there. So in Boston, it was a fellow named Jeremy H. Brown who initially connected me with the LSC and why we're here today. So just kind of a crazy way to get a movie screened through the internet with total strangers. But you know, it's really super reflective of how the changes we're seeing and how culture's disseminated and how artists are connecting with audiences these days. And I think before we get into the movie, I wanted to carve out some time, 20 or 30 minutes, just to talk about some of these changes with these two dudes who are super interesting. Probably most of you know that already. And more important, they're like practitioners of this new type of kind of art and audience connection. And I'm super excited to sort of pick their brains about, you know, when you call a panel the future of anything, in this case it's the future of cultural work, my bullshit detector goes off. And I'm the guy who came up with the title. So I just want to put that out there because I have sat through a lot of panels with a lot of you know, people who are professional pundits, and it's their sort of their casual hobby to sort of pontificate about where the future is going and stuff. I think all three of us have more of an investment, more of an actual kind of day-to-day kind of connection with the things that are changing and how we benefit from them and what the limits of them are. So I'm going to start with you, Andrew, because you're conveniently located immediately closest to me. I don't play favorites. The Kickstarter that you had a few years ago was very successful. I don't want to make this also a Kickstarter rah-rah type of thing, but I also don't want to just sort of like ignore what's happened and what potential there is there. So I was really curious about, I mean, it's been a while, I don't know how long it's been, but it's been a while since you raised that money. And when I saw it happening, I mean, there's a huge kind of like you had a goal and then you reached that goal and then you doubled the goal and you tripled the goal. And from my perspective as someone on the outside, it seemed to me like there was, I was almost like your social capital over the years in the tools you've made for the interactive fiction community, the games you've released for free. It was almost a way to kind of, not cash in exactly, but kind of like, you know, you have your social capital and that's all well and good, but it seemed like the response was kind of related to your kind of standing in the community and such. So how's your mic there?
My mic? Oh, wait, there it is. Thank you. Thank you, mic people. What was the question?
I wanted to know...
yes, you actually pretty much gave my introduction to Kickstarter right there.
Oh, sorry. Yeah,
well, it's been 18 months, I could count the days, since I closed up the Kickstarter thing and quit my job and declared myself to be an independent game person. I am not yet a successful independent game person, and I have not yet completed the Kickstarter project that I was working on, but it is moving along, and I've completed a whole bunch of other related things. Kickstarter is, first of all, impossible to avoid when talking about artists' work in the current, you know, magical era of mid-2012. And B, Kickstarter is the way currently which it exists to turn reputation into money. Money is nice, especially when pitching a project, because everybody likes to get paid in advance.
So have you found that it's affected your relationship to your work when you think about the people who backed you? And, well, I guess, how has it affected your work?
No, I don't think it has. Well, I mean, I've always been the sort of person who sits in a corner and, like, works obsessively on something for a while, and then I release it, and people comment on it, and then I smile and say thank you, and then I go back to my corner. I'm not actually very good at connecting to my audience. Thank you, Twitter followers, for not swamping me with comments. So it certainly helps to know in advance that there is an audience. That's not something that interactive fiction people normally have, but I'm egocentric enough to still keep working the way I've always been working and hope that it's going to come out right in the end.
Okay. And do you feel like, that there's a sense of it, that there is a bubble, that there's a finite amount of time for which a model like Kickstarter could work?
Well, Kickstarter is clearly filling a hole. Like, there was a real need for that, and Kickstarter is filling it. Eventually, the hole will be full. That doesn't mean it's going to stop being possible. It's just that it will no longer be the overwhelmingly obvious first step. Like, people will not turn around and say, well, whatever it is you're doing, it must be on Kickstarter. I don't know how it's going to fill up and diffuse. It might be overwhelmed with spam projects. It might we might just get a divergence of a lot of different social funding groups. We might, you know, it might become commonplace enough that it's no longer remarkable.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, one of the things that occurs to me is that Kickstarter has sort of filled a void of the patron shopper, almost, like someone who, a combination between someone who likes to buy stuff, cool stuff on the internet, but as well has this desire to support the artist in some fashion. And I think, like, previously they'd been quite separate in regards to, you would have people who would be patrons who would be, you know, in the classical sense, and then you would have people who would be consumers. But I think, like, there's a need in some people to be both. So maybe a mass amount of people.
Yeah, I mean, it's also, I mean, not all of Kickstarter is patronage, right? Some of it is pre-orders, some of it is, well, the way Kickstarter works, none of it is charity per se, but you can imagine similar things which turn into pure charity or pure, income, steady income for a company. I expect that it will continue to diverge into various paths like that, and so it's not always going to be just you're not always going to be able to go to crowdfunding and say, this is my contribution to an artist. It might, there are going to be places, well, this is my contribution to buying a thing.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So, Randy, from what I understand, you give away your comics for free on the internet, and you give away your art for free. But people can buy T-shirts with the cartoons on it or prints. And that's sort of like what supports you. Is that?
Yep, that's about right.
And that totally should not work.
Yeah.
That should, like, but it does. And it does for a couple webcomic people. So I'm sort of curious about how that started, how it's changed since you started doing that.
Well, I think a big part of this is that I got lucky, you know, in that I got in right at the beginning. When I started XKCD, I mean, there were quite a few webcomics out at that point, But from what I remember, the term webcomic was still kind of, it was kind of stigmatized, and because webcomics were just gaming and anime and 8-bit sprite comics, and so people were like, there was, and now, you know, there are just so many different kinds of comics that are popular that weren't there when I started. So there's something that I think that I took advantage of, that, and I think the common thread between that and Kickstarter is how much things it isn't that there is more audience out there, because there's, you know, there's the number of people there are in the world, and they have only so much attention and only so many things they're going to care about. But I think what's really the thing that we're only just getting a handle on is the difference between between reaching 300 people who are already connected to you for some reason and reaching 300 people sampled out of the 7 billion people in the world. And when with comics in the past, you really had, like, if you were doing comics in a newspaper, you really had to appeal to a decent fraction of the newspaper's readership. So you had to be really broad. Like, you know, Dilbert did office humor, but office humor is still aimed at a lot of, you know, a huge chunk of people. And all of a sudden with webcomics, and the things that I think that I got in early on, is that you can do something that's going to appeal to, you know, a fraction of a percent of the population. But they don't have to be a fraction of a percent that you've already gathered together somewhere. They can be from all over the place. So all of a sudden, the kinds of audiences you can talk to really change. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the same thing that Kickstarter has sort of gone into this, like, exploded, is that it's taking advantage of that same idea that the potential audience is no longer an audience, a subset of an audience you've already gathered. It's a subset of the internet, which is a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I'm really interested. Obviously, a law has been made of your naive style, the stick man style, and whatnot. And I mean, like, I don't expect that there was a lot of strategy or I like behind that, but in in retrospect,
I tried drawing other kinds of cartoons. Right. But it turns out those are a lot harder.
So I mean, obviously you have a huge audience in the math, science, engineering kind of community, and like it almost seems to me like you become like a troubadour for that kind of generation or something, or like that kind of audience in a way that almost like the naive style makes you more kind of approachable for maybe a group of people that don't have like really super advanced art skills or like, you know, that I mean, I just feel like it's like, more relatable on that level. Like, whereas in, I think when people are super, have like super advanced sort of, rendering skills or whatever, they become kind of distant and kind of like they do this super special thing, whereas in with yours people can focus on the great writing or the concepts and those types of things.
Yeah, I think that's a sort of a characteristic of gag comics and humor. I mean, just sort of telling jokes, you really cut out everything that's not part of the punchline. And I mean, that's, you know, when Peanuts came along, it was the entire rest of the newspaper was these huge half-page, richly illustrated, you know, adventure stories. And Peanuts was really like starkly, it was so few lines, and it was brilliantly like drafted, but it was really simple compared to a lot of what was around it. And I mean, I think that there's plenty of things that limits you on, you know, I mean, you can't tell the same kinds of stories, but if you're trying to just sort of get across a simple punchline or a simple gag, it's a great medium. I mean, I remember thinking it would be really cool to be a cartoonist when I was a little kid, except I didn't, and I was thinking, okay, this is the perfect job because you sit at home all day and don't have to do anything. But I was like, but I don't know how to draw or come up with jokes. So, yeah, so I think, and it was actually when I saw other comics that had, like, no traditional drawing in them, and I was like, oh, you can put stuff up even if, it doesn't have to look like, you know, and like I grew up on like Tintin and things, you know, and like you don't, you can do other kinds of stuff too, and whatever you're doing will, you know, can try to find an audience or not.
Totally. So one of the things I've noticed recently is this growing group of what I'm calling sort of citizen curators, in the sense of like, They're not necessarily trying to be artists themselves, but they're filling a niche in the sense of like they're telling their friends about their stuff, and they're taking it more seriously than you would in a casual way. They have a blog that they kind of regularly update with sort of stuff they think is amazing, or they tweet on a regular basis, or those types of things. And I'm just curious, like, if you guys see, like, because for me it feels like that. Traditional advertising, where you would have a hired gun to get excited about your shit, is dying in some respects, and that this sort of like people are doing it almost for free or pro bono because they're passionate about it. And if you've seen that like in your work or how your work gets out there, or kind of thing.
Interactive fiction, like the text adventure world, has a long history of being sort of self-academic, because for years and years games weren't an academic discipline, unlike today, and so we had to write our own essays and develop our own theory, and that tradition is still there. There are still people who are out there, like Emily Short and so forth, and either edging into the academic world or edging into the commercial game world, but still being the theory people. And I'm sure that goes on in lots and lots of other disciplines as well. I mean, you know, in science fiction, I know the people who write and post about science fiction and are interesting about it, that's a longstanding community. So that, from a basis of two examples, I conclude it goes on everywhere. Whether that's going to replace advertising, I don't know, because that's a good way to be well known in a community, but you don't have to advertise to your community, right? Mm. Advertising is for the people you don't know. So I'm not sure it's going to serve that function. On the other hand, if by chance one of those things blows up and becomes famous, then, you know, you have an in to mindshare, as it were. I hate that I just said that.
Well, I think it's interesting you brought up this idea since everything is obvious, it's clearly so powered by word of mouth right now, in part just because the internet is really disorganized and new, and no one really, like, everyone has a different idea of what, you know, how they want to, what they want to look at and what they want to do. So it's all sort of falling into whatever form, you know, it falls into as people start blogs and people like theirs and they follow them, and it's not in any way, you know, organized. It's just this structure. But I think that there's actually a sort of really worrying potential here, because I think that we're just starting to figure out the potential, how useful it is to have a bunch of people commenting as soon as something goes up.
Right.
You know, like just having that first, like when I started my comic, part of where I got the first handfuls of readers I got was that I posted comments on Slashdot, and I noticed that it didn't really matter how good the comment was, it just mattered what time it went up. And so I would just sort of like refresh, and then like there's a new story, you know, skim the story, tell a stupid joke, and then, whoa, 50 people just went to my website. And I could tell, like, that's a really dangerous road to go down, because and I sort of stopped that after I had the first few chunk of readers. But, like...
Well, we're already a ways down that road, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
well...
Like, any kind of political discussion in a newspaper commentary, mm-hmm. or in a newspaper website, gets a bunch of people, and at this point it's impossible not to believe that a fraction of them are being paid mm-hmm. to, you know, represent political opinion.
Yeah, and yet we sort of have the idea that like people put up votes on websites, which I think sort of says everything you need to know about how what we think about how readership works, and then the results of the votes where Ron Paul takes 97% of anything where he's an option,
right.
Shows you how it actually works.
Yeah. So one of the interesting models I've been seeing in the games world, my friend Paolo does Mala Industria, and he makes political games. And for the most part, when people ask him like how he funds his games or whatever, he just says, I make them for free and I give them away for free and I have a day job. Like he works as a professor, and his thinking behind it is that with political games or political work of any sort, if you're selling it, you're usually selling it to the people that agree with you, which kind of kills the point of making political games to affect change. So when I see stuff like that, I mean, it's such a, when I hear a kind of rationale against selling culture, in the sense that, like, I mean, it's a weird thing to sell culture. Like, we have, it's always based on some previous work, in some respect. So you're always kind of, when you're selling something, there's always a continuity of, like, you're selling someone else's work as well. It's not like something you can entirely separate out. So it makes me wonder, like, at this juncture, like, when we do have the opportunity to reassess, like, maybe, you know, it's like, in some ways, I look at it like love. Like, you know, you can sell love. People sell love and buy love all the time. But should you? Like, maybe not. So and with culture, it kind of has that sort of feel of, like, maybe it has been something that's worked for us culturally up till now, because we've had restrictions on, you know, transporting books that have physical costs and all these other things that are, you know, associated with physical goods. But now that we're digital, maybe, like, I mean, I don't know what you guys think about the potential of just culture being free and us trying to figure out some other way to support ourselves.
I feel like the only possible response to that is to stand up, tear off all my clothes, and run screaming down the hall. you know, it's a little too early in my lifetime as an independent person to talk about not making money anymore. I'm already not making money. That's not the fantasy. I could imagine being in a world where I could, you know, put chunks of my life on Kickstarter and say, you know, it isn't a time for me to do my next thing, and I will give it away for free and give me a pile of money for it in advance. That would be fine if that turns out to be possible. I'm not objecting to that theory, but I'm also not objecting to the theory of making things and selling them.
And it's also, I mean, in a roundabout way, it's still selling. You know, when NPR does a pledge drive, they're still selling a product to customers. It's not like they're producing this radio and they're doing it because they're being paid by the people they're producing it for. It's just through a donation system. It's sort of, you know, the people who can afford to pay for it are paying for it.
And they don't have to worry about DRM.
Yes.
That's true. Yeah, one of the reasons I bring it up is because for so long, selling a product, a cultural product, has been associated with credibility. If you can sell enough products to support yourself, you're considered a real artist in whatever form you have. And I feel like that has so many problems with it. First being just that, you know, I cost about $20,000 a year to survive, but other people take 40 or 60 or 80 or, you know, yeah.
Boston is more expensive than Toronto, yeah, I'm sorry.
So, I mean, but it's wildly different, right? So someone who might make twice as much money as me selling their books, but not enough to do it full time like, you know, I do, can consider themselves not a real artist, or their credibility is hit somehow because they're not entirely sort of sustaining themselves off of the sale of a product of their work. So I bring up the free culture thing as a kind of challenge, I suppose, to this notion of culture has to be sold because we need to support artists in this fashion. Whereas in, I feel like there's different ways to do it and different ways to sort of challenge the notion of what, who gets to be the real artists and who get to be the part-time artists and sort of sheepishly say I do it as a hobby, even if they're mm-hmm. just as passionate as people who sell enough product. So on that subject, actually, you'll see over there, DVDs of Ghost with Shit Jobs are on sale after the show. And we're going to go into the movie section. I'd like to take a big hand to this guy. Guys. Thanks very much. I'm gonna remind you guys all to turn off your cell phones because you don't want to be that guy with the ringing cell phone. And afterwards, stick around. Myself, Anthony Cortez, and Sean Lerner are going to be doing a Q&A after the presentation of Ghost with Shit Jobs. Thanks very much for your attention.